Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's November 1st, 2019, not really, it's a day late, but, and you're listening to the best Ante Up podcast on the sea. I'm Scott Long, Chris Cosenza is pruning a tree somewhere. And we are aboard the Adventure of the Seas at the very end of a fantastic eight-night cruise. And we got an interesting panel of folks here. We got a longtime cruiser. We got a first-time Ante Up cruiser. Elliot, of course, is here. And then, of course, me in the background. So we're just going to go around and introduce yourself so everybody knows who matches the voice. So we'll start here with
Sean. Sean Hamstra from Michigan. I've been listening to Ante Up for like 10 years.
Excellent.
First time on the cruise. Yeah, in that first year, I spent the whole time catching up on all that.
And you you brought your wife, and it's your eighth wedding anniversary, is that correct?
Yep.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah. So we went on a cruise on our honeymoon, now we're back here.
Very nice.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun so far.
Good. I should have asked you that before I had you on the show. But took a little chance there. But all right, Joe, tell people who you are.
Joe Boyd, a longtime cruiser, probably the 10th or 11th. Can't count which one anymore.
Oh, you've been on more than that, I think. But,
easily. Well, I'm just Ante Up.
We've had 36 cruises already, so.
I've only done, I think, 10.
I'm going to double-check that math when we get home, but all right.
Sounds low.
We'll say at least 10, right?
At least 10.
Easily.
All right, Elliot.
Hi there. I'm Elliot Schechter, a longtime call-the-floor columnist for Ante Up Magazine, contributor to the podcast, and a longtime cruiser. My shipboard life has been pretty good, and, well, glad to be here.
All right, well, I like about this little panel, let's call it, you randomly put together here. Sean's on his first Ante Up cruise, about a long-time listener. Joe's on his more than 10th cruise, I'm sure, I promise you. So he can give you that long-term perspective. Elliot's been on probably
five or six.
Ante Up, though.
Seven for Ante Up.
Seven on Ante Up, and, of course, I've been on 34 of the 36, so... I outrank you all, but so here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the cruise a little bit. We've had a lot going on this last seven nights and give you a little flavor of the cruise from all kinds of perspectives in case you're thinking about joining us in the future. But I always like when Elliot's available to chat so we can chat about some industry stuff because I know you guys love firing off Call the Floors. In fact, Sean, you were just on the show a couple weeks ago. Was it Call the Floor or Listener?
Both.
All right.
Because, yeah, had that bounty.
That's
bounty
right.
That was split.
And we may have Jonathan joining us, too, who was on that same show with you as well, too. But he's right now railing his wife, who's in the final three of the main event. So didn't want to take him away from that. So
I was out in six.
All right. Well,
the Buble.
Here's the thing. When you go home, just tell folks you final tabled the main event. They're never going to ask you how many people or whether you made any money or not. So.
There you go.
All right, so just a couple things I'll say from my perspective on this cruise. One, this is a cruise that I've been waiting for since I first saw it on the schedule, and I immediately sent our agent the information, and I'm like, God, I hope we get this. As folks listening probably don't know, it's actually really difficult to book these cruises. So at the beginning of the year, I put together a list of all the itineraries that we can go on. Obviously, we use the history of which ones have sold well in the past, which ones haven't. And narrowed it down. We check our competitors, make sure we're not overlapping. Although, interestingly enough, tomorrow Card Player leaves from the same port that we're coming in. And next week, Ship It Cruises leaves from the same port we just came in. So those folks don't play nice like we do. But anyhow, so it's very complicated. And then also we have to deal with the fact that if another group has booked the conference center space, and it's not a poker group always, sometimes it's sewers or... somebody else. So we don't always get our first choice. Sometimes we don't get our first five choices, so we have to do what we can. But this one I really wanted to get. I'm glad we got it. And the reason I liked it is it's that really rare eight-night cruise that we haven't had before. And it's a weekend to weekend, so folks that have jobs I feel bad for you guys. But for those of you who have real jobs, you only have to take 5 days off of work to come on here. And then great ports that we don't have to, that we haven't made it to in a long time. So I want to talk with our guests here about experiences they had. Now, from my perspective, we went to four ports, Labadee, which is Royal Caribbean's private oasis. I keep calling it an island because it's not an island, but it's an oasis, I guess they call it. And then San Juan, Puerto Rico, and then St. Thomas and the United States Virgin Islands, sorry, and then St. Martin, Dutch Island. All fantastic times. Interestingly enough, is we don't get to these folks these places very often, and I spent three of them just sitting on the beach. So I could have gone anywhere and done that. But we had a fantastic time in San Juan. Elliot and I did, and then some of our other staff played archery tag.
Yes.
Something I didn't even know existed until.
Sounds dangerous.
We created the Hunger Games. Yeah. May the odds be ever in your favor.
So if you haven't heard of archery tag, which I hadn't, you get a bow and arrow. And now Joe was there to watch it. He didn't participate. But you get a bow and arrow, but the arrows actually have big marshmallows on the end. Not real marshmallows, but they look like marshmallows, so you don't really hurt yourself too badly. Although, I got tagged once or twice and thought about it. But it's nothing like dodgeball that I play with at home.
No,
so.
Much less harmful.
Yeah,
full cardio workout.
Yes. Wow. Yes. It's not made for old folks like us. I'll promise you that. And then, of course, we get done, and our guide, who is like, 12, told us about this Puerto Rican moonshine shot that we could take. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we did
Pitorro.
All We did that. And then Elliot and then other folks went on the excursion that I'll leave it up to them if they want to talk about it. I didn't want to do it. But I had a wonderful dinner and then finished up my favorite cigar shop. So that was a great day for us. So I don't know if you guys want to talk a little bit more about that day. And Sean, I don't know what you did in San Juan, but
we did a food tour.
There we go.
It was actually really good. Yep. We did another one in St. Martin.
Two food tours.
All
right.
San Juan one was better. They went through. We just did a walking tour through all of it. The guy was great.
And how many places did you go?
Three places. So there's kind of an appetizer, meal, and dessert. And there's drinks at all of them. So it was
big fan of drinks at all of them.
Yes.
So what was the entree course?
I don't know how to say it, but it was plantains and this chicken and rice. Okay. They had some fancy name for it. We actually matched the
Mofongo
ourselves. Oh, wow. Yes.
Yes, Mofongo.
That's it.
I didn't know what that was until this trip either, but my dining companions loved it. Fantastic. So.
Yeah, that's good.
Did you do anything? I saw you did a food tour where? St. Martin as well?
St. Martin.
Okay.
Yep. That one's pretty good too. Not as many drinks, but we stopped at a beach at the end, which was beautiful. Gorgeous beach. Out of ways. Not the one by the airport.
No airport beach for you.
We drove through that one. That one was terrifying. We didn't stay there. It's only like 3 feet wide.
Well, yeah, here's an interesting thing I was interested to see is obviously the hurricane came through, 2 years ago, right?
Yes.
And devastated all these islands. The one that got the most press, I think, was Puerto Rico, of course. And I had to be reminded when I got here that San Juan wasn't the brunt of that, right? So when I got off the ship in San Juan, I was very impressed to see. I could see almost no damage at all. I mean, anywhere we went, I didn't see too much. But St. Thomas is a different story.
St. Thomas.
And St. Martin a little bit, too. Fine. And the two things I noticed the most were the beaches, because I've been to both those beaches before, and they don't exist anymore.
There is
a little tiny strip of sand.
Exactly. It moved all of the sand away. There was nothing to walk on. Yeah. Hopefully it comes back for them soon, but...
Yeah. It was definitely
our driver said that the beach he expects within the next rainy season to have all that sand come back. It has in the past, and that's what he was telling us. So that should be nice when you get back out there and have some room.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned driver. One of my Uber drivers in San Juan was actually in a Puerto Rican boy band, the Salsa Kids.
Salsa Kids. He was pretty good voice,
pretty
too.
Darn good, actually, yeah. So,
seemed a little bitter, but yeah.
Never had a celebrity Uber driver before, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I asked him if he keeps in touch with the other Salsa Kids, and I got a very firm no. Yes. So I don't know what happened with the Salsa Kids there, but... So, Sean, what did you guys do in St. Thomas? Anything out of the ordinary?
Went to the beach.
Beach, okay.
Yep, just walked around a little bit.
All right. St. Thomas, not a lot to do there, I found.
Yeah, we took the taxi across to the other side, to the Megan Beach. Whatever.
Okay.
Yep, so that was nice. But the driving was crazy. Terrifying.
Wow.
Up through the mountains, around all these corners.
Welcome to the Caribbean.
I just wanted to make sure their brakes worked.
That's a gamble there. Plus, no stop line, no stop lights, no stop signs. Mm-hmm. Very free-form driving.
Yes.
Yep.
All part of the experience, though.
Absolutely.
All right, well, on board, we played a lot of poker. I actually played a little bit more than I expected to play. Finally, I got to play with Sean last night, which felt good. And so we had an interesting discussion right before the show, too, about right before the main event, whether I was going to play or not. And I tend not to play tournaments on board. I try not to play cash games, really, to be honest, unless I needed to get games going or keep them going, or last night when my seat's not needed. But it is an interesting challenge that Chris and I have had over the years. We've got Annie Up fans that listen to the show or read the magazine or whatever, otherwise know us and come on and are looking forward to playing with us. And then we have a lot of passengers who don't know us from dirt, other than we're the owners of the company and now we're sitting down to take their money. And I never like my passengers just feel uncomfortable. So we err on the other side of not playing as much. But unfortunately, that means we don't get to play as much with the folks that want to play with us. So we at least got a couple of good hands last night. We traded chips back and forth, right? So I don't remember who got the best of who. But
you had the Cosenza on one of them.
That's right. Yeah.
Took me there.
8-10 suited. Yeah. Love it.
Oh, God.
But I certainly remember my aces over your queens.
Yes, that is right. Yes. So
that I won't forget.
Tit for tat, yeah. all right, well, let me ask Sean, your first time on the cruise. So what were your expectations coming in? What were the reality of it, and how does that compare? Because I know we have folks out there who have probably been thinking for 10 years like you have about coming on a cruise.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. Much more like home game friendly feel, which is such a relief, especially when you're on a cruise. You want to go in there and just be super intimidated and have to be super serious all the time, but great group of people, a ton of people that have been here before. Surprised. I don't even know if I found anyone that hadn't been on here. I know there were a few. There are some. But yeah, the friendly game atmosphere was awesome. The other thing that I hadn't heard of before were the Survivor tournaments, where everybody starts and play for 2 hours and whoever's left splits the money, which I cashed in both.
Excellent.
Maybe that's why I like them. But
and maybe we'll get down to the show in time for you getting the next
one. It was just interesting. I've never done that format before, so that was pretty cool.
So, Elliot, from an industry standpoint, I mean, Survivor tournaments aren't very popular in actual casinos, right? They make sense for us here on the cruise because we need a finite end time, which is why we do it.
You generally only find them as part of a scheduled event on a tournament series.
Okay.
You will find plenty of 10% survivors, whereas you play down to the 10% of the field as opposed to having a time limit.
Right.
The time limit tournaments.
Almost like a satellite.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They have basically kind of fallen off for the most part.
All right.
Not a common format anymore.
And you made an interesting suggestion, and I'll be interested to see what Joe and Sean have to say about this. We've never done this way. We've always done a survivor where you play for 2 hours, and no matter how many chips you have left, you split the prize pool evenly with everybody else. So if you have 1 million in chips, and somebody else has 5 in chips, you both get the same amount of money, right?
Of course.
This cruise, it's interesting to me. It's all very interesting to me. This is our 36th or 37th cruise, something like that. And all of them are completely different, it seems like, right? We can never, like, predict the crowd until we get on board. This crowd was a lot of cats hanging on to the curtains, right?
Yes.
There weren't a lot of, like, aggressive get the money in and get out quick. There were people holding on.
They were hoarding their last chip like it was worth platinum.
Right. Now, I get it in the Survivor because, you know, again, you only need that last chip, right? You don't need more than one chip. You just need that last chip.
You have to survive the blinds.
You have to survive, right? So your suggestion, which I'll see what Joe and Sean want to say about this, is to combine our bounty tournament with the Survivor tournament. So on our longer cruises, we do bounty tournaments, green chip bounties. So your idea is that would kind of encourage a little bit more action, correct?
Yes. When I format Survivor tournaments, we always put 50% of the money in the pool and 50% in the bounties. So not only does it encourage you to actually continue to play in the tournament, but it vastly increases the action. The more chips you accumulate, the more people you eliminate, the more bounties you collect. You can theoretically, through the use of bounties, get more than first place had there not been a sharing system in place.
Plus, you're also forcing people out of the tournament so we don't have a 9-way chop, which we had yesterday. So you make more money that way. So what do you kids think about adding the bounty element to the Survivor?
I think it's a good idea because what I've seen, and I benefited on one of the trips from that, was someone just sitting there not playing, holding their cards like they're thinking, and then walking into that final 4 or 5 minutes and then cash him, when in reality, you know, he should have played 3 or 4 more hands.
Sure.
And they would have been forced to play their blind, and that might have changed the outcome and knocked a few more people out.
Well, I think interesting, yesterday I watched the end of it, too. We had one woman who had one chip left and was waiting for the blinds to get around, right? So, and she survived, and I felt good for her. She seemed very excited, too, and everybody at the table seemed very excited.
Yeah, group was too friendly.
Exactly, right? But if you have that bounty element in, now I'm going to guess that there's somebody at the table was not going to be that nice in those last couple hands, knowing that if you raise and get her to commit, you pick up an extra bounty and split that prize pool 8 ways instead of 9 ways. So, yeah, I think we're going to think about that. In fact, actually, Ramsey, our poker manager, we spent some time with Elliot yesterday talking about all the tournaments. I think we're going to revamp all of them in some way. So I'll throw out some ideas because Joe, you've been on 47 cruises, even though you say it's only 10. So we always do a $100 main event, which is what's going on now, which we give the most chips. But comparatively to your normal casino tournament, we know we don't give you that many chips. But as Elliot will be the first to point out, it doesn't matter how many chips you start with. It's the structure and the chips. So
that's right.
You could give somebody
blind levels. What are the blind levels? Much more important than the actual starting stack. We're starting with a million chips, but if the blinds are 50,000, 100,000, you're not starting with anything.
That's not starting with anything, right? And you have a tournament you were telling us about up at Hollywood Toledo. That's
our
60,000
starting
Uber,
if you're listening, we'll still take sponsorship. I emailed you twice. You still haven't replied. 60K starting stacks, 10-minute blind levels. First blinds are 100-100. And it goes well. It's easily our most popular evening tournament of the week.
And you get, what, 60, 70 or so players?
We usually
roughly
get between 60 and 70 sometimes.
Okay. And it's about a 4-hour, 5-hour tournament, right?
Just about 4 hours.
Okay. Which is exactly what we try to do on the cruise ship, and with probably fewer players, depending on.
So you've changed the blind structure to fit the time you
want
it to end?
No. That's just
how it plays
trials.
Out. Yeah.
We played it over so many months, and that was the average length of tournament. We didn't plan on having a 4-hour tournament. My dealers are scheduled for 8 hours. I just assume they were all 8 hours. But that's the way it turned out, and it works out perfectly. The players are fine. They still got to go to work the next morning.
Well, you're right, because that's what a lot of players, when they say they want to play a long time, don't necessarily mean that. And when you give them a bunch of chips, because it's like, yeah, I got chips to play with now, but if the structure is such, it's still going to end in roughly 4 or 5 hours. I think that's ideal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I'm one of those crazy ones that likes all the friggin' chips.
Well, you're not the crazy one. I don't think you'll find too many poker players that wouldn't rather have more chips than fewer chips.
Right.
And I also don't think you would find all that many recreational players, which is what we attract on the cruise, that really understand how the structure changes that. So if we give you 100,000 chips, which we're actually thinking about, we probably won't go that far. But I would imagine our players would be ecstatic, even though the tournament's still going to end the same amount of time, because that structure is not going to be the same structure that we use now. But it is kind of the reality of poker now that over the last, what, probably 10 years, probably less than that maybe, where it's really gotten chip inflation, as I call it.
It's, yeah, just under 10 years.
Yeah.
The Venetian came out with their deep stack events. Thank you. And everybody else has pretty much had to follow suit. The World Series tried to hold out, but even they gave in, and now they have vastly.
But again, the interesting part of that argument is that I know I've talked to a lot of operators who have been kind of upset with the Venetian about that. But then you go back to your point, the chip stack is just one element
right
in it. So
exactly. We can alter the blind levels. We can alter the blinds themselves to make up for the fact that we're giving out way too many chips. Mm-hmm. And it's caused us to buy more high-end and high-value denomination chips, and now we're stuck with an inventory of low-value chips that are now collecting dust all over the place.
So in a real sense, that's the only downside, the only true downside for a casino in this chip inflation is having to buy chips and not use chips you have, right? Yeah. Otherwise, as long as you adjust the structure
and
to whatever you want.
The storage of said chips.
Well, true, yeah.
Behind the scenes in casinos and in the cages, I mean, every cubic foot is accounted for. I mean, we can only store inactive chips for so long. I mean, we eventually give them away as souvenirs.
Hmm.
But decommissioning chips is not an easy process in a regulated casino.
No, in fact, actually, I heard some places you have to bury them in concrete and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, or you have to have them shredded under the supervision of multiple gaming agents.
I think I'd start a fire. I'd like to melt.
They're ceramic.
Ceramic right? might not, yeah, sure. Well, you could turn them into a like ghost, like Patrick Swayze and stuff. Do some pottery.
Oh, man.
All right, so, Sean, you're from Western Michigan, and I know you play in a home game, right? Do you get to Firekeepers or some other casinos often? Or
Gun
mostly?
Gun Lake's the one.
Gun Lake's the closest, okay.
Yeah. Or advertising.
Yes.
I just noticed just the other day. I sent you a message with that later. Andy Up Magazine sitting there, which I hadn't seen before.
What do you play when you go to the casinos? Are you a tournament, cash game, both?
Both. Lately, I've been playing cash game, but just to get ready for this. I normally play just home games.
Okay.
So I've been getting to the casino more to try it out and move up the stakes a little bit.
So a question for both you and Joe, in terms of the cash games that you guys play versus wherever you play them versus on the ship, what are some of the differences that you would say for folks that are at home wondering about coming on?
Well, I've been playing a lot more home games rather than going up to the casino, which I used to do tournaments. I always played tournaments when I went to the casino. So the one we play 1-3 here versus 1-2 at home, and it's just a little bit bigger for me anyway. It's a little bit, you know, a little bit bigger game that I'm still trying to get comfortable playing.
Yeah, see, for me at my casino, we're playing smaller here with the 1-3.
Okay.
It was common at my casino for raises to be a 10-15 at least for opening raise. Here they're 7-8-10, sometimes they're more.
Yeah.
Course, but I was a little intimidated at first. I was thinking it was going to be a big game, but you know, I've been buying in for 200 and playing real comfortably. Yeah, the other comparison for me, like I said before, it feels much like more like a home game, but then with all the professional stuff taken care of for you,
right.
So it's super nice. So it's like you got a bunch of friends there, people you're just meeting, but they're all super friendly, and then you're taken care of well with the dealers and the floor and stuff. So
yeah, I think the first day on the open bar cocktail party, I was talking to your wife, and you mentioned that you thought there were some pros on board, right?
Yeah. Some
has that played out?
Yeah,
I haven't. I've seen a couple
Judy
good players, but
saying that, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't think any of them are pros.
Did not experience that myself, but I didn't play as much.
Certainly,
as you
there's
guys
some
have.
Good players, yeah, but I don't think they're pros.
Yeah, and what I told you, and I'll tell our listeners at home if they don't know this. I mean, we purposely price our tournaments. Mm. To discourage that kind of player from being on board. Obviously, we don't do a litmus test. We don't ask you your experience level when you book. So, I mean, if you are a professional player, you can book and come on. But my experience with folks that I know pretty well that are pros, when they ask me about coming on the cruise, they ask me about the tournaments, and I'm like, well, our main event's $100. And they laugh at me, and I'm like, good, I'm glad you're laughing, because I don't I like you. I like you to come on the cruise and have fun, but you're not the type of player I'm trying to attract. I'm trying to attract that recreational player that's just coming on here and looking at fun, particularly on an 8-night cruise, because we were talking about that just today. Starting to see that some folks' bankrolls have evaporated towards the end of the cruise, which we don't normally see on a 4-nighter.
No, there's a few extra nights they haven't accounted for when they pack their wallets for the trip.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No, obviously, I would imagine there are players that are winning, so they're all right, too. But, you know, on the edges, you haven't seen it. So, Joe, all right. So, again, let's go to 10 cruises, even though we know it's more. What have you noticed over the years in the changing of our cruises from players or how we've done it or anything? Is there anything that's changed for the...
I remember when it first came on, we were doing a lot of sit-and-goes.
Right.
And really people that were just starting to learn how to play.
Right, right.
And I think now it's still a lot of recreational players, but they play more often, maybe is the term to use.
Right.
I think they're more consistent players. And, yeah, we don't really see anybody that's, quote, a professional, but there's some people that play a tremendous amount of poker.
Right.
But I think when you're at the lower level like this is, they can't play the same way they play that they're normally used to. And I don't think they have the big an advantage over this field because, I mean, just, you know, short-term luck has an indicator during these short cruises. And if you're playing regular, you don't have to get beat bad. And, you know, you got a good chance of walking over money.
Doing all right. Yeah.
Which I didn't do on this trip.
The other interesting thing, I was talking to a first-time couple that was on our cruise today, and he was playing the main event. She was, and she played a couple. I think she played her $20 rebuy, which I think we're going to scrap now going forward. But she was talking to me this morning about how she's – and we get a lot of these spouses, not always women, sometimes men, that know just enough to be dangerous, right? They know the hand rankings. They know how the blinds work. But they haven't played enough to really feel comfortable sitting, even in a $20 rebuy tournament. And one of the things that she was worried about is, like, you know, players don't know how I'm playing, because I don't even know how I'm playing. And to my point to her was, that makes you pretty dangerous, yeah. Doesn't it?
It makes you very dangerous.
I mean, no one wants to sit down and play against a pro, but
we got seven deuce. Playing this cruise.
Really?
Yeah. One lady's, her favorite hand is seven deuce.
She's playing
and
it now.
And she's hitting it.
She's hitting it. In the money of the final really event. Well. In event.
Yeah.
All right. So, Elliot, I mentioned I want to talk a little bit industry. So one of the things I thought was interesting in our conversations this week is that you're getting ready to run your first short deck tournament up at Hollywood Toledo.
We've had plenty of our tournament players asked for it. They've seen it other places. They heard about it. What is this short deck game? Well, in short deck hold'em, there are a few new wrinkles. They take out everything below the six. So the deuces, trays, fours, and fives are out of the deck. So you're only playing with 36 cards.
I still can't get a hand, I bet.
It's really weird. And to make the hands, there's two changes there. The ace does wrap around the lowest card. Now the six to make the nine high straight, just like it wraps around the deuce to make a five high straight. Because remember, in poker, the ace is high. Unless you're playing specifically low or high low, ace is high only. So to wrap it around, that was an invention that started a long time ago, way after the game started. So in this game, they continue it. And in the second part, because there's fewer of each suit, flushes beat full houses. Remember... You're getting, instead of 5 out of 13, you are now getting 5 out of 9. Uh-huh. If you get 5 out of 9, well, congratulations. Yes. You almost hit the lottery.
Right, yeah.
I have never played the game myself. I've played it as stud, where you take out everything below the 7.
Which I hadn't heard of until you mentioned that. That's
Asian stud is still being played in a couple card rooms in California.
Probably, yeah. That's because of California, right?
It's dollar ante, and then they play the big game, $5 ante, and high card brings it in. And that's an exciting game, but I've never seen it as hold'em. I've heard about it, and I've read about it, and we're finally going to do it. The last wrinkle is there's no blinds.
Mm.
Everybody antes, and the player on the button double ante.
Oh, okay.
So every round starts from first active left of the button.
All right, so here's my big question about that. I know that's kind of the new hot thing, but we've seen new hot things every year for the last however long I've been in poker, right?
Yeah, Apollo and Omaha has been the game of the future for at least the last 35 years.
At least that one's been holding on, again, like the cat on the curtains, right? But some of these other variations have disappeared pretty quickly.
Faded very quickly.
At least disappeared from the casino environment, largely. Mm-hmm. Like, we thought open-faced Chinese was going to be the next big thing. And
Downriver hold'em.
Only being played on any of cruises
right.
Among the staff, but... So what do you think the staying power – well, two questions. One, I'm surprised the short deck ever made it out of, like, California and Vegas. So when you said it's coming to Toledo, Ohio, that means something to me, right? That means that
it's
there's
already
enough discussion that it's getting on there. So then what's the lifespan of short deck? Is this another fad like we've seen or not?
I think it's another short-lived fad.
Okay.
I think the game is well-named short deck. I don't think it's going to last a while. Maybe – I don't even know if it'll last to the end of 2020.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be catching on. It's catching on enough where people are asking about it. It's not catching on where all of a sudden you see a short deck tournament with 500 players.
Well, it is like everything else. So, I mean, you run your tournament at Hollywood Toledo, and you might get 400 people. You might get 10, right?
Exactly.
So if you get 10, then it's probably not going to be offered again, right? If you get 400, it's going to be on the weekly schedule, right?
Darn right.
So, which I think is what happened with Open Face Chinese, is everybody is excited playing at home, but when you actually had to...
Right, we played that one tournament at the Golden Nugget with 80 of our best friends.
And,
well, they tried it one more time, and that was it.
Done.
I've seen it listed on Poker Go. There must have been some big tournament.
Oh, really?
For a short deck. And, yeah, I never knew what it was. And hearing that now, it'd be too confusing for me. I mean, you catch on to it, but I have enough complications with Hold'em.
Well, one of the things I tell folks about these new games is if you're on the front end of it, you're going to clean up. Because at that point, you've got a lot of curious players. And I would admit I'm a curious player. I'll play anything if you teach me how at once. And I think it's interesting. I'm obviously not going to be very good at it at the beginning. And if you are better than me and you've got a bunch of me's in the game, you're going to clean up until eventually the game dies. So to that extent, if you're on the front end of these games, that's where your profit is. But, you know, eventually it's going to dry up.
Yeah.
Or everybody's going to catch up to you to the fact that you're back to Hold'em.
Well.
And not that Hold'em's gotten any easier either now. So.
No, it's gotten more difficult. But the knowledge difference is still not as great. You look at Pot Limit Omaha, the knowledge difference was vast enough where the game didn't grow. It's just that the people who knew about it could survive.
Right.
Everybody else died off. The games were have not continued their existence, like Open Face. The knowledge difference was so great that the money accumulated to too few players, and everybody else realized this is not the game for me.
Right.
So maybe Short Deck will hang on. I don't think it's going to have a rosy PLO type future.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk about Hold'em then, because we know that's never going to disappear. So
never, please, never.
Interested to see, because Joe's been playing. How long have you been playing poker, Joe?
10 years.
Really? Okay. That's, only 10 years.
Well,
okay.
I played cards when growing up, you know, stud, but never for money.
All right. And then, no, Sean, pennies. You've been playing for how long?
Pennies.
Since the boom.
Since the boom. So all right. 15. So 15-ish or so years. And you've been playing
25 years?
70, 80 years?
Oh, well, just about. Yeah. Oh. I had some work done. I'm looking a lot better.
And again, I've been playing for maybe 20 years or so. So I was telling some people this last week. I'll be interested to see if you guys disagree with me, though. But obviously, I think we all agree that poker's changed a lot since we first started playing. Even 10 years, it's changed dramatically, right?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I really notice when I tell people is, because if you're not a poker player, you like to latch on to these TV slogan things, right? Like poker face or bluffing and all that kind of, and reading people, oh, he's got a poker tell. And so what I've been telling folks is lately, I think, not that that stuff's not important. It's still important. If you can get a tell on somebody and the physical stuff, that's still there. But the game to me seems like it's gotten much more mathematical in the last couple of years than it ever has been. Obviously, limited poker has always been a math problem, but no limit's a little different, right? So the players I see doing really well now are more, I think, introverted maybe. Players that aren't as social as the boom. I mean, during the boom, right, we used to watch TV and we had all these characters on that got us excited. I don't think we're generating as many poker characters these days because the type of people that are playing now are math whizzes. And math has taken on a much bigger role in No Limit Hold'em than it has in the past. So let me know if I'm wrong.
I think you're spot on. Most of the players are wearing sunglasses, they're wearing hoodies, they're not saying a word, realizing that they could possibly give away the least little bite of information by doing anything other than just staring straight ahead or moving their chips forward, which has made the game less fun to play.
Right.
I mean, while playing poker is not sociable, you're not there to be nice and give away money, it is social. It's played amongst people. And somebody coming in like that who doesn't enjoy the social aspect or participate in the social aspect of the game is, they basically playing online poker, except in a casino, which
much slower.
Right, and they're all taking their time.
Yeah,
yeah, which makes the game much less fun.
So, have you guys seen that as well too, or is that a figment of Elliot and I's imagination?
I think it's a little bit higher level, because at the real recreational level, all the guys I play with just play for fun. Most of them don't study the game; they just come and play. And you try and give them information on some of the math and on some of the things they should be doing, and they don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, they have no patience. They don't want to wait. They come down. The guys that come in on an infrequent basis because they can get to the game,
right?
They just come and basically throw money at the table.
Well, and this is, we talked about this.
Not big money. It's not big money, but it's, you know, it's like, yeah, they're not worried about it. And sometimes it bugs me because I'll sit there for an hour and I'll play a hand. And yet the same three guys are playing between each other and nothing changes until one of them goes broke.
Well, I thought this was interesting. We did our, we brought back our strategy roundtable, which we used to do on a lot of cruises, and then people quit coming. And this cruise, we had an entire day. We weren't able to open the poker room, but we had some time, so we brought it back. Unfortunately, not a lot of people showed up for it, but Joe was there, Elliot was there, I was there. And one of the things you mentioned, Joe, I thought was interesting was that you are a consistent winning player in your home game with these folks, but you don't feel like you're growing as a poker player, or it's different when you get into other games.
It's hard to expand and, right, and move out of that level game because I just never did it. And before, when I was playing tournaments, I was enjoying that, and I was moving up into some of the tournaments, but I still didn't go often enough to put enough money out there to see where the heck I'd really be.
So, Sean, do you see that in your home game? Do you guys same group of guys? Or I should say, yeah, same group of players, right? I don't know.
If yeah, we have a pretty big pool, but the same dozen or so mainly play. We got a couple guys that are a little higher level, and those are always fun to tangle with. And then if you guys, well, like my dad, he just comes in and then he doesn't know what he has, so he's really hard to play against. Yeah, exactly. You either win a lot off him or lose a lot to him. But we have a healthy mix. And at the casino, too, I'd say about half of them are just recreation. They're for fun. They're socializing. The other half are serious. They're into the math. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that's going to grow more because usually the younger guys that are like that, and it's more the older generations that are a little more fun and they're not quite as serious. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I like getting to the math, too, and having that at times. But, I see quite a bit of split.
Well, yeah, and I've talked about this on the show because I'm in this new Safety Harbor Poker Club where I live with all these players that aren't very skilled, but it's fun to go there with a $20 bill and four cans of Miller High Life and just remember what poker used to be, right? And, you know, if I win some money, that is great. If I lose 20 bucks, that's what I would have spent at the movies that night, right? So to me, there's an element of that. It's kind of cool that that's coming back in my life. At the same time, over the 14 years we've done this show, we get a lot of questions from home game people about that difficult step from moving from home game to playing in casinos. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's so difficult is you get used to playing with the same group of 10, 15, 20 guys, and maybe none of them or very few of them or fewer than you are trying to move up. They're just there to have fun. And I think it's very difficult in that situation to become a better player until you get out of that comfort zone and go play with some of the folks, even coming on a cruise when you're meeting different styles, even though it's not as cutthroat as
I think a lot of people would be surprised, though, if they just get out there and play a little more. The more you do it, like I said, I started going to a casino a lot more right before this, and I had to play for like at least an hour just folding everything before I even felt comfortable to start getting in there. And then by the end of the night, it was feeling good. And then here, too, especially when you get to know people, that's what makes it real fun when they start to socialize with it, even if they are a higher level or thinking really hard on stuff. The social players are what keeps the game alive and keeps you playing when you're sitting there silent.
And I think it's one of the things that gets people into our room more often than that is the, you know, first two or three days you finally make friends, and then everybody seems to know everybody by their name in there. I was kind of feeling bad. Our game last night was like kind of a library. I felt like I wish we could get the conversation going.
It was tired.
But I think that might be what it is. But I think that's a rare example here. I mean, usually when I'm walking around the room, even not playing, like all the tables are having some good conversations, and not just about how many lobster tails they had at dinner that night, but you know, about real life kind of stuff. So, all right. So, Elliot, anything else from the industry that we haven't? Any new trends? Anything that things you're worried about? We got the big blind Andy kind of sorted out. I know you had a change your mind a little bit on that, right?
I didn't change my mind so much as I went with our corporate directive. having spent the good chunk of my playing in actual stud games, I was always for Ante first as opposed to Ante last. Ante, from the Latin before, means it's supposed to go before anything else. It's supposed to start the pot, so that when the cards are actually out, there's something to play for. So I was totally in favor of it. I went along to go along. I mean, I didn't want to be giving out a different product than any of our sister properties. I work for a pretty big company. But I was very happy to see that we were able to, at least this year, coalesce around changing the rule and adopting Annie first, which is the way it should be. I hope it stays there. I know a couple of casinos are really hesitant to make that change.
Still holding out. Yep.
They're really holding out, even whether it's button Annie or whether it's Annie last. I don't think it's right, especially in a game where you can have no player on the button. Why would you want to button Annie now there's less chips in the pot?
Sure.
And again, for Annie last, sir, you can re-enter. Everybody else paid your ante. It's your time to pay their ante. It's very, very fair. There's nothing fair about letting you have all the action but not covering the ante for all the players who covered your ante. So I'm completely in favor, and I'm glad we made the change. I hope we stick to our guns.
All right, one more thing I wanted to ask you about, too, that we're starting to see is the selling of casinos to real estate investment trusts and then leasing them back to the casino companies, right, which I think is an interesting development because I don't know if you've seen the movie The Founder with Michael Keaton about sure. the history of McDonald's,
mm-hmm.
where somebody – of course, it's the Hollywood version, right? But they encouraged him that his business isn't selling hamburgers. His business is owning the land.
Absolutely.
So now we're seeing the exact opposite going in the casino industry where casino operators are realizing, hey, our expertise isn't in owning the land. Our expertise is running casinos. So do you see that as a trend that's going to continue, or is that just more the financial realities of these big companies that are the ones that are doing
yes
it?
To both. I work for Penn National Gaming, which owns the original trust, Gaming and Leisure Properties, and GLPI. The two other main trusts are VICI, which is Caesars Real Estate Trust, and MGM's trust is the third. Between the three, they pretty much own almost all of the land and facilities in which 70 to 80% of the casinos in the country operate at this point. The other 20% are either the few independents left or the Indian casinos, which have no reason to sell. They already own everything, including the land. They're doing it for taxation purposes. They're also doing it for capital expense upkeep. These companies have been fairly active in the mergers and acquisitions game, and that has left them with not a whole lot of spare change left to actually update and maintain their properties. So they're doing what seems to be the equivalent of taking out second and third mortgages,
right.
Borrowing against the equity of their homes so they can finally keep them up to maintain shareholder value. I don't know how much more I should comment other than explaining this.
Well, let me ask you a question. What's the reality for players in all this? Because I think a lot of times players don't really understand. You know, if you're a player, you go to a casino, you sit down on a poker table and you play poker. You're not concerned about this corporate hierarchy or any of that kind of stuff. Is there any real effect on players in this this development?
There can be, because, and I have experienced this firsthand. I work in a casino, and now I work in two casinos, where we don't own what we're standing on or what we're hanging stuff on. So if I want to hang a television or a painting or a picture, or I want to change the furniture, I have to run it up a pretty high flagpole.
Yeah, okay.
I have to ask the owners of the building, not just the people I work for.
Hmm.
So, yes, players may see some changes, and it may not all be great because you may be waiting longer to see things done. But when they are changed, they'll be fun. They'll be fantastic. Things will be kept up much better. Caesars was notorious for letting some of their facilities go because they just couldn't put money into the capital expense budget. They had to pay interest.
Right.
Well, so, I mean, a lot of places will see fantastic improvement and we'll see a great effect of somebody else owning the building and having that liability. For the most part, nothing will operate any differently. The companies that are operating the casinos are licensed to operate. They will keep doing things the same way they have been doing, and mostly it's been successful. So there shouldn't be a whole lot of change. Some change will take longer, but most of it will be pretty good, actually.
All right, so one last question before we quit. Big debate in the poker world over re-entry tournaments, late late registration that's been going on. Matt Savage is kicking off a big no late entry, no re-entry, same flight series now, and he just put out on Facebook, and I assume on Twitter too, hey players, this is what you asked for. You need to show up and actually make it work, because if you don't make it work, we got to go back the other way. So let me ask Joe and Sean, what are your thoughts on late entry, re-entry? Are they important to you as players? If they disappeared, would you be upset?
I would not be upset with them going away. The one entry or two, I don't mind a second entry, and I don't mind allowing people to come in within like the first hour. Even on a really big tournament, I think 2 hours is like kind of pushing it. And now they're going 7 and 8 levels and 10 sure. levels. And that just, it turns me off when I go to play them. Because it's like, you know, you're playing against the same guy 3 times. Right. Nah, it's not right.
Kind of like an archery tag.
Chips 3 times.
Like archery tag with a medic.
Yes.
I'm like, hey, Ari, I already shot you with my marshmallow.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Sean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't really mind the late entry. I haven't really experienced too much of the re-entry until now. I was a little confused here on the survivor. Mainly, I've only just dealt with rebuy. And to me, that's very straightforward. If there's a rebuy, you're going to rebuy. And I hadn't really even – I mean, I've heard about it in the poker world, but I hadn't experienced the re-entry thing. It'd be nice if at least some tournaments that wasn't there, you know, so that players just get one shot and we all just go for it. That's what I've always liked, but I don't really have a big problem either way.
All right, so Ellie, from the industry standpoint, if Savage wins on this and runs a pulls this off and players respond to it, is that enough for
I'm wishing him all the success in the world. We're in a different age. There's casinos everywhere. Back in the day, there were only tournaments in Mississippi, Nevada, and California, and well, you traveled to the tournaments and you were already there. Well, now you're driving 2, 3, 4, 5 hours to a casino and driving back. It's a big difference. If somebody's a few minutes late, 20 years ago, they weren't getting in the tournament. Well, now if they're driving through an ice storm and they finally make it to your place, I'm not in the mood to tell them no. As far as reentry is concerned, from my perspective, it's a negative because now you really can't budget your labor. You can't decide how many labor hours you're going to need to complete a tournament. You're not going to really have a handle on how many chips will be in play. It makes it a little more difficult. Yes, it's a challenge. That being said, remember from the player's perspective, if a guy has re-entered 10 times, he doesn't have 10 stacks in front of him. He's got one stack. That means he donated nine buy-ins to the prize pool. Please do not be upset if somebody's re-entering constantly. It's good for you. It's bad for him. He is underlaying the field. He has to finish so far ahead of the minimum cash to actually get his money back. He's only helping you. On the other hand, he's hurting the casino. Let's face it, it's going to take us a lot more time to get this tournament done. There's more chips in play.
Sure.
I hope he's successful. I hope it works. LA has how many millions of people living there?
Yeah.
With how many millions visiting on an annual basis? If it's going to work, it's going to work there.
I was going to say, I mean, that's the biggest lab beaker you can have for it, right? So, I mean, you could try this at Gun Lake. You could try this at Toledo. You can try this at even some of our lakes in Florida. But if it works there, it doesn't mean it's going to work everywhere.
No.
And this doesn't mean it's going to work everywhere either. But at least you're getting a much bigger sample size than I think you would in some of these other places. So.
Well, and that brings us to the other end of the equation, the prize pool and the guarantee.
Right.
If you limit the entries, you have to limit the guarantee mathematically. Excuse me.
It's just like starting chips at construction. Right. Work in tandem, right?
Yeah, darn right. So the other big thing, of course, with inflated chip levels is pretty nice-sized guarantees on major tournaments, especially out in California. Well, if you're limiting entry, you can only put in so much money in a prize pool and get a guarantee so big. So hopefully the players can be satisfied playing a tournament with, egads, no guarantee. Oh, no, the sky is falling. So, yes, I hope it's successful. I'd love to rip some guarantees off these tournaments.
Part of me wonders this, and I wonder how much you've thought about this, too. I wonder how much the guarantees actually mean to recreational players. I mean, obviously for pros that are trying to plan their travel and they they do this for a living. I get that. They want to know there's going to be a prize pool there. I honestly don't hear, and maybe Joe and Sean can disagree with me on this, I actually don't hear a lot of recreational players or even a step above recreational that sit around and worry about a guarantee. I think if they want to play a tournament, they're going to play a tournament. And if there's a big guarantee, that's great. But I've never heard anybody at my level say, I'm not going to play that because it's only 50,000 guarantees that amount of cost.
You're onto a lot of it. Most recreational players are not worried about what the final outcome is going to be, but they certainly are attracted by something that is what would be a good deal to anybody.
Oh, well, yeah. Let's say I've never owned a new car. I bought one for my wife a couple years ago, but I've never owned one myself. I get all the little shiny new things that it does, the collision blinkers and all that kind of stuff. And I like it, but I get back in my 2002 car that has none of that.
Right.
And you know what? It drives just fine. So
I'll give you firsthand experience. At Hollywood Casino Toledo, I'll say that very clearly. several times a year we run major events, and the opening event is always something priced in the same range as a daily tournament.
Okay.
And we put a phenomenal guarantee on it. So it attracts a lot of players who are recreational who would not normally worry about this, but all of a sudden they see the same price tournament they're playing every single week of the year all of a sudden has a guarantee 100 times what normally would pay.
That makes
they're
sense.
They're very attracted by it.
Right.
They're not thinking about, oh, well, this translates into exactly 12,700. No, they're not even worried about any of that.
But so in that sense, you're saying that players that otherwise might be on the couch that night or at a baseball game or a movie theater now because of the guarantee you're actually going to play.
Yes.
It's not so much a main event where they're probably going to play no matter what that guarantee is, right?
I think I can put some perspective on it, too, for recreational players, just who aren't thinking about, oh, they'll probably have this many entries, this much money will be in the prize pool type of thing. Like, they probably have no idea. But then when they see the number up, they're like, oh, that's actually quite a bit of money, even if the guarantee is, like, always met, you know, but they don't think about that beforehand. So it is nice to...
But would that encourage you to play or not to play that number? I guess that's my question.
It has... yeah.
that's why I was asking.
Yeah, I've gone a couple of them where I know the prize pool is going to be 50 or 100,000 because I don't get to see that all the time locally. And it's like the time I ran up with you guys, that one didn't bother me so much, but I think there was a guarantee on it. And that made it interesting.
Right. And, well, you were driving,
I was driving
16 hours or something to get there. So
I didn't know I was
story,
driving
right?
that far, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm more concerned about the folks like in Toledo, in Detroit, in that easy driving market, right? Where it's not a commitment to make that drive. And
it certainly attracts that.
Versus the, let's say, the Columbus, Cleveland, Indianapolis crowd. Maybe not Indianapolis, but a little bit farther out of that. Now it's they're making a commitment for that day or even farther away, right? But
yeah, they're making a serious commitment. Booking hotel rooms. And major tournament guarantees. I mean, look at Firekeepers, not too far away from Illinois. The Firekeepers, hell of an operation. They run an excellent tournament. They do great events. A couple times a year, they're running a $1 million guarantee, and I'd imagine that number in that area has attracted a lot of people to make the drive. It's not, I mean, Firekeepers is in less of an area than Toledo is, but it's close to everything. It's situated exactly halfway between Chicago and Detroit. So, I mean, they get a lot of pull from places where people actually do live.
Which goes back to this is more of a geographical, right? Because we talked about this at the TDA, like Sean McCormick from ARIA got up there and said, hey, there are 40 other poker rooms in this city. I got to do what I got to do to keep people in my room because it's too easy for them to walk next door versus a casino in the middle of nowhere where
darn right.
It's the only place to play. So
if Firekeepers didn't do that, they would probably lose a lot of their business to the Chicago casinos running their major events. And they run lots of major events. So, I mean, if they didn't make their mark, they wouldn't get the attention.
All right, we're going to wrap up here. I just want to thank Sean and Big Joe and Elliot for joining us on not only on the show but on the cruise as well, too. We got three more coming up, but we got a four-nighter in April out of Tampa over Easter weekend. Both Joe and Elliot are going to be on there. We haven't talked Sean into it yet, but... It's not really an anniversary, right? Anniversary and a half, maybe. We'll see.
Next May 2nd will be a 15-nighter transatlantic to Amsterdam. We also got some good bookings, and I think we talked Big Joe into the coming on that as well, too. So I'm feeling pretty excited we're going to have enough to make that happen. I hope so, because I've been planning my post-Amsterdam partying also on this cruise. And then a year from now, in October, we'll be doing a 7-nighter out of Galveston. So go to AntyUpCruises.com, get all that information, and book. And we'll be back next week with our regular show. But
yeah, I need that April cruise to make diamonds so I can go
on. Yeah, that's a diamond.
Get all your free drinks.
Got to get a free drink for change.
Oh, God.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, guys. And we'll see you on a future cruise.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
AntiUp is a production of AntiUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AntiUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@AntiUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.